Welcome to Doctors of the Church. In this fascinating series, Father Charles Connor examines the lives and writings of all 33 Doctors of the Church, including St. Thomas Aquinas, Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, and Catherine of Siena. Now, here's Father Connor.
Hello and welcome once again to this series on the Doctors of the Church. We mentioned last time that His Holiness Pope Pius XI had occasion to name four doctors of the Church during his pontificate. We've already looked at two of those doctors, St. Peter Canisius and St. John of the Cross. Today we want to look at the two remaining doctors of Pius XI, Robert Bellarmine and Albert the Great. St. Robert Bellarmine was the product of 16th century Europe and the Counter-Reformation. The Counter-Reformation, as we have seen many times in different series, centered around the Council of Trent. And from that Council of Trent came many, many reforms to counteract the Protestant Reformation of those days. Catechisms were written defending the Catholic faith. Bishops who were staunch defenders of orthodoxy were appointed to principal dioceses, particularly in and around Western Europe. And there was a great deal made to bolster the faith of Catholic lay people, and also to reform the moral laxity that had entered into the clergy. So it was a multifaceted attack that had the principal result of revivifying the spiritual life of the Church and also counteracting many, many, many heresies that were rampant in those days. It was then in that world that St. Robert Bellarmine lived. We know that there was a great reform of many of the existing religious orders, and we know that new religious orders began to sprang up. And one of those religious orders that began to sprang up was the Society of Jesus that was established by a Spanish Basque by the name of Saint Ignatius Loyola. It would be that Society of Jesus of which Robert Bellarmine would become a member. Raymond Schmont, a church historian of some decades ago, summed up very well this new Society of Jesus that was coming about in the Church. Stamped with Ignatius' military outlook and his genius for organization, the Society of Jesus became the principal agent of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. In size and accomplishment, it dwarfed all other orders. St. Ignatius had caught both the spirit of the Church and the spirit of the time more completely than did the founder of any other religious order. And the perfect combination of the two does much to explain the amazing accomplishments of the society. Now, St. Ignatius structured this society around his spiritual exercises. And the spiritual exercises had a great deal to play in the role and in the life of each and every Jesuit. Schmont continues, "The best short description of the exercises is probably the author's own full title. Spiritual exercises whereby a man may be able to conquer himself and so order his life that he is never under the domination of any inordinate affection whatever." Now that was the purpose of the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, and that was what totally dominated the spiritual life of any man who would enter the Society of Jesus. So, armed with such spiritual fortification, the candidates who entered and who had undergone formation in the Society of Jesus, or as it was more popularly called, the Company of Jesus, could be described as individuals, and we quote once again, individuals desirous of carrying arms for God and of serving only Jesus Christ, our Lord, and the Roman Pontiff, his vicar on earth. They would be disposed to take vows of perpetual chastity and to labor for the advancement of souls in the Christian life by preaching, by spiritual exercises, the hearing of people's confessions, and works of charity. The Jesuits adopted the three ordinary vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and a fourth special vow, placing them at the Pope's service. So they were an extraordinary company of men who sprang up in the Church in the 16th century. By the time Ignatius died in 1556, there were 12 provinces of Jesuits, more than 100 houses with 1,600 members, and 65 missions scattered around the world. The driving power of the Jesuits was due largely to the system of education which the society adopted and which became one of the chief instruments of the Catholic Reformation. How do you reform people? How do you educate people against the heresies of the day? You take them and you put them into a classroom and you teach them sound doctrine. This was the whole modus operandi of the Jesuit universities as they began to spring up in the 16th century. So it was this very impressive society that Robert Bellarmine chose to enter. He was described as one of the greatest polemical theologians the Church has ever produced and her foremost controversialist against the doctrines of the Reformation. So, Robert Francis Romulus Bellarmine. He was born in 1542 in Tuscany, and as a young boy, he showed tremendous potential as a student. He knew Virgil by heart when he was a youngster. He wrote excellent Latin verse. He played the violin, and he was particularly adept, we are told, at public disputation. You and I would call that the art of debate today. They would say public disputation. The Jesuit headmaster of the college where he was studying described him as a young boy as the best of our school and not far from the kingdom of heaven. The best of our school and not far from the kingdom of heaven. Well, at the age of 18, he goes to Rome to present himself to the Father General of the society. His novitiate was shortened somewhat so that he could get at his studies more quickly. He was a brilliant, brilliant student. Before his studies in the Jesuits were completed, St. Francis Borgia, who was the Jesuit general at the time, asked Robert Bellarmine if he would complete his theological studies at the University of Louvain in Belgium. The reason why he was asked to go to Belgium is not simply to complete his theological studies, that he would do, but also to lecture in theology to the students who were already studying in the University of Louvain. The University of Louvain in the 16th century was an absolute hotbed of heresy. The chancellor of the university, Dr. Michael Bias, was preaching heretical doctrines, and most of his faculty were in line with the chancellor, and therefore heretical doctrines were being preached to the students of the University of Louvain. And the Jesuits, who were this strong counterforce of Catholic orthodoxy, realized, we have to get to the University of Louvain and rid it of what is going on. And therefore, Robert Bellarmine was asked to go there, and he went. And he was to spend 7 years, and he had an enormously, enormously successful time of it at the University of Louvain. His lectures were extraordinarily popular. He was a small man physically, and he had to stand, we are told, on a stool to make himself seen and heard. Nevertheless, he succeeded very, very well with the students at the University of Louvain. Well, Bellarmine was finally ordained to the priesthood in the city of Ghent in Belgium in the year 1570, and then he was given a professorship at the University of Louvain. He was the first Jesuit to ever hold such a teaching position at the University of Louvain in Belgium. When he went back, he began a series of lectures on the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas, and as you might very well imagine, his classes were filled. And he used the classroom very, very effectively to dispute Chancellor Michael Bias, and many of his other colleagues on the faculty who had accepted erroneous doctrines. He challenged them in such matters as grace, and besides grace, free will, and besides that, papal authority. Grace, free will, and papal authority. They seem to be the strongest themes. It's interesting, too, the way Robert Bellarmine conducted his, shall we say, theological attack on the university. He did it in the greatest, the most charitable way one might imagine. We spoke in the last episode of Peter Canisius. Canisius operated in the very same way. He would attack heresy, but not the heretic. Well, Robert Bellarmine was at the University of Louvain. He was attacking heresy, but not the heretic. He never mentioned his opponents or his adversaries by name. But he was so strong and so convincing in the Catholic doctrines that he enunciated that his opponents had to know that his points were directed at them. But they could never attack him because he was doing this so very, very charitably. Now, this approach that Bellarmine took, that Peter Canisius took, and for that matter, many other Jesuits took, goes all the way back to Ignatius himself. Ignatius insisted The refutation of heresy must always, always be done in a very, very charitable manner. And that's why these men were as effective as they were. They were not controversialists in a personal way. They were not going after individuals. But they were making their points so strongly and so convincingly that they won many back to the true faith once again. Well, in the midst of a very, very demanding, grueling schedule at the University of Louvain, Robert Bellarmine also managed to study Hebrew, to study the fathers of the church, and to study a great deal of scripture. And those studies were going to enhance him very, very much in his later career. His health gave finally, and he had to leave Louvain. St. Charles Borromeo tried to get him to Milan to teach there, but instead the Jesuits assigned him to become professor of what they called controversial theology at the Roman College. And for about the next 11 years, he would be a very successful professor of theology at the Roman College. That Roman College building with which Robert Bellarmine was associated so many centuries ago is still very prominently there in the Eternal City. And not very far from the Roman College building, you will come to the magnificent Church of San Ignacio. St. Ignatius. In that church of San Ignacio, you can pray at the tomb of Robert Bellarmine. And you walk out the door of the church of San Ignacio, and down the street on the other side, just a stone's throw, you will come to a residence which is called the Bellarmino. The Bellarmino is a residence for Jesuits from all over the world who come to the Eternal City to pursue graduate studies. So you see, the spirit of St. Robert Bellarmine in our own day is still very much alive and well in the Eternal City of Rome. During Robert's teaching years in Rome, he also wrote four great volumes in his disputations on the controversies of the Christian religion. And about three centuries later, a church historian commented on those books. He said they were the most complete defense of Catholic teaching that had been published up to that time. His work showed a tremendous grasp of Scripture and the fathers of the church, which he had gotten in his Louvain days, and just as fundamental a knowledge of current heresies. So he did indeed have a tremendous effect in his writings. This particular series that he wrote when he was in Rome really spread throughout the world. And one of his biographers talks about it in this way. He says, the success of his controversies was instantaneous. Laymen and clergy, Catholics and Protestants read the volumes with avidity. And even in an Elizabethan England where the work was prohibited, a London bookseller declared, "I have made more money out of this Jesuit than out of all the other divines together." Isn't it interesting? Well, in 1592, Robert Bellarmine was named rector of the Roman College. 2 years later, the Jesuit Provincial of Naples. And 3 years after that, he returned to the city of Rome as personal theologian to His Holiness Pope Clement VIII, at whose expressed wish he wrote two very, very famous catechisms of the Catholic faith. And there are some people who have made the claim that these catechisms were translated more frequently into foreign languages than any other books except the Bible and The Imitation of Christ by St. Thomas Aquinas. For this, for so many accomplishments, Pope Clement VIII made Robert Bellarmine a cardinal. He did not want to accept it, and he continued living as a cardinal in Rome in very, very modest circumstances. Though obliged to occupy apartments in the Vatican, his biographer writes, and to keep up some sort of an establishment, he relaxed none of his former austerities. Moreover, he limited his household and expenses to what was barely essential. He lived on bread and garlic, the food of the poor, and he denied himself a fire even in the depths of winter. Well, in 1602, Robert was somewhat unexpectedly named Archbishop of Capua. He left Rome shortly after his appointment, and he threw himself with all the intensity he could muster into pastoral work. Only 3 years later, a new pope had been elected in the person of Paul V. He was determined to bring Bellarmine back to Rome. Bellarmine became the head of the Vatican Library, and he began sitting on most all of the Vatican congregations, and he became very, very adept in Vatican matters, particularly in the art of Vatican diplomacy. In his later years, he continued to write, not necessarily in a controversial vein. He wrote commentaries on the Psalms. He wrote about five spiritual books, and perhaps the most famous spiritual book that he wrote was his famous Art of Dying. He knew his own life was coming to an end, and he thought that he could help many others by writing a book on the preparation for death. That was Robert Bellarmine. The final doctor that Pope Pius XI named was not a Jesuit. He was a Dominican. He was not Italian. He was German. He did not live in a period of great controversy in the church. He lived in a period when there was a tremendous flowering of the intellect, of the mind, and of Catholic thought. His name was Albertus Magnus. In Latin, we would call him St. Albert the Great. To this very day, you can go to the Dominican Church in the city of Cologne, Germany, and you can pray at the tomb of this very, very wonderful man. His influence still lives on in Dominican scholarship, as it is found in so many corners of the world. And I suppose the greatest claim to fame that Albert the Great could make was one of the pupils he taught. Because the most famous pupil of Albert the Great at the University of Paris was none other than Thomas Aquinas. He, who was such a profound master himself, had at one time in his life been the student of yet another master. Albert the Great laid a foundation upon which Thomas Aquinas would later build. These 13th century giants, then, of thought are both doctors of the church. And we want to look just a bit more now at the career of Albert the Great. Many scholars break his life down into several categories when he was doing philosophy, when he was doing theology, and they all make the point that whatever category of his life, whatever period of his life you're referring to, he was making very, very original contributions. Now, what was it about Albert that accounted for his uniqueness? Well, one contemporary philosopher has summed him up this way. Albert is important because of his steadfast recognition of natural human knowledge, and in particular philosophy, as a valid and useful perception of truth, and hence as a discipline of value, autonomous within its own sphere. He accepted philosophy as the Arabs and the Jews had accepted it, as a vision of truth on the natural level, valid within agreed limits, and therefore to be sought out for its own sake, as a part of the knowledge of creation given to man as his birthright and heritage. The principal guide and repository of this knowledge was Aristotle, and Albert proposed to himself the task of presenting the whole of Aristotle to the Western world. He tried to show that philosophy and science are not in themselves hostile or dangerous to the Christian faith, and he tried to exhibit their value to contemporaries who were often suspicious of profane learning or even positively hostile to it. He was neither a thorough Aristotelian, nor was he a perfectly consistent thinker. He mixed Aristotelian theories with ideas derived from Plato, from Neoplatonic thought, and even from Islamic philosophy. He was quite a remarkable man. A man no less than godlike in all knowledge, one contemporary said, so that he might fitly be called the wonder and miracle of our age. Even the famous Franciscan scientist of those days, Roger Bacon, referred to Albert the Great as an authority, and he said that his works were original sources. Albert was, as so many of these doctors of the church are, of very noble German birth. He was a Swabian by descent. He was born in 1206 of the family of Bolstadt in a castle on the Danube River. We do know that he went to the University of Padua for studies as a young man. And in 1222, the Dominican Master General, a very famous man in his own right, Jordan of Saxony, wrote to a friend. He wrote to a friend and he said that he had received ten postulants for the order, and two of them are the sons of great lords, counts in Germany. Well, one of those two, of course, was Albert himself. His family were anything but heartened by his entry into the Dominican order. They thought that a career in the world would have been far, far more to his liking, and far more in keeping with his talents. But he did become a Dominican, and a very famous one. He immediately undertook a teaching career that took him to places like Hildesheim, Freiburg, Regensburg, which was going to play an important part in his future life, Strasbourg, and Cologne. And through it all, Albert the Great was establishing a tremendous reputation within the German Dominican province with his lecturing, with his teaching. He was insistent that he was going to create a center, if you will, of Western culture. Albert's entire body of works fill 38 volumes, biblical and theological treatises, and many, many sermons come down to us. He also was very adept at the natural sciences. Listen to what he accomplished in his life. This is one biographer. He stands beside Roger Bacon as a great natural scientist, whose aim, he says, is to investigate the causes that are at work in nature. And some scholars have claimed that he did more than Bacon himself for the advancement of scientific study. He was an authority on physics, geography, astronomy, mineralogy, chemistry, and biology. He wrote a treatise on botany and another on human and animal physiology. As a geographer, he received special praise. He traced the chief mountain ranges of Europe. He explained the influences of latitude on climate, and he gave an excellent physical description of the Earth, which he demonstrated by an elaborate argument to be spherical in shape. The breadth, the absolutely outstanding breadth, then, of this man's mind. But, of course, his chief claim to fame as a doctor of the church would be his work in philosophy, and especially his realization of the use that could be made of the philosophy of Aristotle in Christian theology. What he did was try to take Aristotle and make Aristotle acceptable to many, many, many Christian critics. As one writer has said, Albert was the principal pioneer and forerunner of the preferred system of the church. He collected and selected the materials. He even laid the foundations. St. Thomas built the edifice. Once again, as with so many of these men, you have in the case of Albert the Great a man who is teaching philosophy, who's taking the philosophy of Aristotle and trying to synthesize it and make it acceptable to the Christian theological mind. You have a man who's lecturing, a man who's building up a reputation around Western Europe and particularly in his native Germany. And yet you also have a man who is rendering significant contributions to his own order, the order of friars preachers, the Dominicans established by St. Dominic. Throughout his long years, then, of teaching and writing, he was a very practical man, as well as being a scholar. These talents, these practical talents of Albert's, were very, very well used in the Dominican order. There were often internal disputes within the order, and Albert was called upon to try to adjudicate, to try to placate, to try to balance warring factions, and so forth. While he was in Rome, he filled the office of Master of the Sacred Palace. In other words, he was for a time the personal theologian and canonist of the Pope, which is something that was often held, usually held, by a Dominican friar. And before his career was over, in the year 1260, he was appointed the Bishop of Regensburg in Germany, a church which has been described as turned upside down in spiritual as well as in temporal matters. He was in that position for less than 2 years when the Pope finally accepted his resignation. He really, really tried as the Bishop of Regensburg to straighten the diocese out. But there was a lot of political intrigue and Albert had many enemies. And therefore he had to resign. He went back to his scholarly teaching career again. And he was on his way to the 14th General Council of Lyon in 1274 when he received official notice of the death of his pupil, Thomas Aquinas. Isn't it curious that the pupil would have died before the master? Albert the Great, by 1274, was no longer a young man. He was considerably up in his years. But he went to that council, and he took a very active part in the council. And probably one of the last public appearances that St. Albert the Great made was a public defense that he was called upon to give of some points in the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas which were coming under attack. It's ironic that the master was called on to defend his pupil. Throughout Albert's writings, there are frequent signs that his whole life was one of remarkable holiness, but there were also signs that as long as he wielded a pen, he fell short of the saintly suppression of self that distinguished St. Thomas. It was not until Albert had laid aside his pen and had taken to expressing his profoundest thought in tears that we feel ourselves in the presence of a candidate for canonization. So it's kind of interesting. When Albert is involved in argumentation, the human Albert comes out. And because the human Albert came out, some of the people were rather skeptical. And his canonization was held up for some years. But finally, when he was declared a doctor of the church, he was in effect canonized a saint of the church. And Dr. Albert continues to teach us all. These then were the four doctors of Pius XI. And how blessed we are to have them.
Be with us next time to learn more about the Doctors of the Church here on EWTN, Global Catholic Radio.